72 holes, one epic cause. Cancer Council's The Longest Day is the ultimate golf challenge. Four rounds of golf in one day to support people impacted by cancer. Have you got what it takes? Register now at thelongestday.org.au and get ready to tee off for a cancer-free future. Hello and welcome to episode 106 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine trying desperately to answer that eternal question, what is it about this game? Rod Murray's my name, and on this episode we're going to meet a man who for the best part of 35 years was as much a part of the Australian golf scene as any of our high-profile players. By his own admission, Andrew Langford-Jones fell into his dream job as a rules official way back in 1988. But what started as a one-off helping hand at the Bicentennial Classic eventually morphed into the role of tournament director of the PGA Tour of Australasia. Over the years, there's barely been a major golf event at home or abroad that Langford Jones hasn't been a part of. And during that time, he's collected plenty of wisdom and more than a few good stories, which I hope that you enjoy hearing today as much as I did. Well, Andrew Langford-Jones, we'll start, as we always do, by saying thank you, because the thing about golf is quite a commitment, though you are, as we just discussed, technically retired, though more semi-retired these days, so we appreciate that. The clue's in the title, it's our jumping-off point. What's the thing about golf for Andrew Langford-Jones?
Well, I fell into the game pretty much as a young fella, playing with Dad, playing down at Rosebud Country Club was my first... where we have the tournament now, was my first club. We were the founding members of it. Wow. I remember walking in an emu line or whatever they call it down the fairways, picking up sticks and, then I got, played here and got up Rossdale and then Kingston Heath and then, recruited pretty much by the tour. And, Trevor Herden was involved in those days. And, anyway, I ended up, director of tournaments.
Well, it's been a great interview, Andrew. There's a bunch of stuff that happened in between there, was from the time you first started at Rosebud. And what a beautifully common story that is amongst golfers. And Brendan Jones tells the same story about down on the south coast of New South Wales, picking up rocks on the fairways as you played your round on a Saturday to get the course to where they are these days. What's happened in between? You didn't start your working career in golf, though, did you? So you've obviously been a lifelong golfer, but golf wasn't your employment early on.
No, after I left school, I went to university and did law and realised that I didn't want to be sitting behind a desk doing conveyancing for people. So I got into a business consultancy. We opened that up and that's really where I started to meet some golfers. Terry Gale was probably my initial contact in the golf world. And from there... I got offered the job here at the PGA Tour. Well, the PGA Tour, as it was in those days.
Those days separate from the PGA. Yeah, and correct. They were together, they split, and then back together again. Of course, tell me about your first job. That's a terrific story, this one, how you fell into it.
Well, I, it's a long time ago now, but friends of mine knew Terry Gale, who was a Perth golfer. And when Gailey came to town, I'd go and watch him play. And as happens with a lot of the golfers, you form friendships. And then Gailey started staying at our place. And every time he'd come to Melbourne, we were the host. And I guess the tour and the PGA had only split recently, and they were looking for a director of tournaments. And a couple of jobs were offered to me, but I couldn't afford to do it because I had kids at school and the tour wasn't paying that much at the time. But I'd introduced Trevor Herden to Terry Gale, who was caddying for him, and I suggested to Terry that Trevor would be the perfect person to take on that role. But in those days, there was this, hesitancy about appointing someone who had been a caddy into the role. But Trevor had never been really a caddy. He was recruited by first Greg Turner, who was a mate of his, and he was just helping him out. And then when he left Greg, I suggested to Gailey that Trevor would be fantastic for him. And they formed a friendship, and from that, Trevor got the job as director of tournaments, and the rest is history. And then he, I remember he asked me if I'd be interested in helping him do a tournament here in Melbourne.
This is where I was coming to, because this is, I think, a terrific story.
And I said, Trevor, I know nothing about the rules of golf. He said, look, don't worry.
Perfect rules official, really.
I'm perfect, like, yeah.
The players will tell you what they want. You just agree with them.
Well, I remember he said to me, he said, the two things you got to remember, first of all, they're not going to call you for ruling if they know what it is. So, yeah. And secondly, if you get caught, just get on the radio and call me and I'll sort it out. So that was 1988. My first tournament, believe it or not, was the Bicentennial, which was the biggest tournament
the country had ever hosted.
Yeah.
By far. Run through some of the names of people in that field, because it was an extraordinary tournament.
It's unbelievable. I'm struggling to remember. Felder was playing, Couples was playing, Norman, obviously, Roger Davis, all the big Australian. We had a great field that particular time.
And at Royal Melbourne, we're recording this in the what do they call them? So Golf Australia, PGA, the Australian Golf. I think they've got a podcast studio at their home here at Sandy Links, just across the road from Royal Melbourne. They very generously let us use it for today's recording. It was here across the road at Royal Melbourne, which we just saw in the Asia Pacific Amateur. Did you realise then, I imagine you must have, what a special place Royal Melbourne was and what a special event you were a part of, that Bicentennial Classic?
Yeah, look, I always knew how good Royal Melbourne was. In those days, it had low fences, and I used to jump the fence quite regularly as a kid, and we lived in Sandringham. In fact, that in itself is quite a story. I never realised how serious it all was. I was just helping Trev out. And so Terry Gale was staying at our place. We had a house just here in Sandringham, which was about 300 metres from the course. And I remember Trevor said, now, I want you down on 17. And I said, yeah, that's good. Anyway, I got bored. So I had my golf cart and I went out the front gate across the Sandringham, this course here.
Sandy Links.
To home where all the players' wives, Peter Fowler's wife, Mike Clayton's wife, they were all at our place having a barbecue. And I've driven in the thing and I can remember the radio going, because the communication was such that you could hear. Trev said, how's it going on 17? And I'm thinking, I'm in my backyard.
Cooking sausages.
So I said, oh, all's good, Trev. He said, where are you? I'm on my way to see you. And I thought, bloody hell, I better get back to the course. So I'm out the driveway, across the ovals, across Sandringham here, and he's saying, well, where are you? And I said, I'm down by the tee. He said, all right, I'm coming down. And by then I was onto the 18th fairway, and he gets down to the tee. Where are you now? And I said, well, I must have passed you. I'm up at the green. Anyway, Trev never found out that I'd been home watching it on telly until about 3 or 4 years later.
It's a wonderful Keystone Cops moment. We've lost something from the whole world, not just golf, haven't we? That is an unthinkable scenario to play out today. Right from Trevor saying to you, I want you to do the rules, even though you know nothing about it, to the ducking home. None of that could happen in the modern day, could it?
No. No, it's a different world. And the guys, it's so much more professional that the guys themselves are so much more. In those days, they all played golf because they loved golf, and they were all more interested in the game of golf than
business.
The business or the profession of being a professional golfer. It was a fantastic era for us.
The money now is eye-watering, though, isn't it? You couldn't survive, I don't think, in the modern game necessarily with that attitude anymore. It's big business.
Those days there was there was Stewie Ginn, there was Bobby Shearer, there was Stanley. They were all wonderful blokes. But when I compare them to what Greg Norman changed the game, there's no doubt in my mind he changed the game.
Not just here in Australia,
in fact. No, in the world. I mean, Greg started going to the gym. Well, no golfers went to the gym in those days. And
unless you walked through it to get to the bar.
Correct. He and Felder probably changed the game.
And of course, we see the result of that being Tiger, and it's a natural evolution.
Tiger took it to another level, and now they're all there.
Yeah, in fact, one of the biggest rooms in this complex is the gym.
Correct.
Which at a golf facility 40 years ago would have been unthinkable.
Well, we never, when we do a site visit, one of the, never ever discussed whether or not there was a gym or thing, but I guess by the turn of the century, you know, that was one of the main features that we had to find, facilities for the players to work out in.
There's an old saying, Andrew, of for everything you gain, you lose something. For everything you lose, you gain something. You can see that in golf with what we've just talked about there, can't you?
Yeah, the guys were more, it was more of a, we were like a travelling circus, and they were all the guys that eat together, they'd go out together, that, you know, and that happens today still, but not to the extent that it used to be.
Yeah. And it's so competitive now too, isn't it? Much more so than perhaps it used to be. Yeah, I remember Peter Senior told me when he first went to Europe with Wayne Grady, you'd Monday qualify most weeks, but if you shot 75, you'd generally get in.
That's right.
Shoot 75 now, they won't let you on the golf course.
You starve.
Let alone into the tournament. You must have some great memories, and we'll come to that, but I want to come back to that Bicentennial Classic. That's a real baptism of fire. And from there, you went on to then join the tour, I think, as a rules official. It was a bit of a come down, your next event? Well, did you think to yourself, hang on, what have I done here?
Well, I remember we did all right that week. We didn't have any.
Reading any famous stories. No. A rule snafu that ruined the whole thing, so you got away with it.
There was no controversies. But at the end of the week, this is what it was like in those days, and I shouldn't say this.
That's what we want.
I hope there's a limitation on the taxation department.
There is.
Chasing us, but at the end of the week, Trevor Hurden came up to me and he gave me this white envelope, and I think there was $500 in it. He said, look, that's for helping out for the week. And I thought, geez, $500, and they've given me a golf cart, I've travelled around the course, I've watched the best golfers in the world, I've had an absolute ball. And he said, you wouldn't consider coming and doing a few more? And I said, oh, bloody oath. And this is good fun. Because I had my own business at the time and with two other partners. And so I considered it. And by that stage, my first lot of kids were off my hands. And so I went to my partners on the Monday and I said, look, I've been offered a bit of a job. I'd like to take 20 weeks holiday a year. And we'll sort out the internal finances later. And so I started doing every tournament. Trevor and I did every tournament. And we had, I think we got Hank Barron, who was an ex-player, was helping us. And that was about it. There was the three of us, and we'd recruit someone in every city. And it was fantastic fun. So for the next that year, I did pretty much all the tournaments, and we were working 15, 16 weeks in a row, and it was tiring. It was hard work. Now with the HR departments, you can do 2 weeks and you've got to take a month off.
That's exactly right. There's elements of it as well. They're long days too, aren't they? Golf administration, rules and those sorts of things, it's kind of like being the secretary manager or the club captain at a golf club, isn't it? There's in fact, I remember a club captain said to me, it's a good thing this is a volunteer position because you couldn't pay someone enough to do it. Behind the scenes is much harder work than people realise, isn't it?
Well, you couldn't do our job unless you loved golf and loved the guys you were with. And they respected that and they treated you as such. And so, unlike today, we used to go out to dinner with all these guys and, we were part of a travelling family. Mm. Now it's far more isolated. Blokes go their own way and do their own thing. Of course, they have dinners together now and again, but not like it used to be in the old days.
Yeah, indeed. You would have seen the game evolve. You mentioned there you did 15 or 16 weeks in a row. You'd kill to have 15 or 16 weeks of tournament golf in Australia. Now, we are, in fairness, the PGA has done a fabulous job over COVID and beyond with the Players series of events and some of the things they've done there with the women and the men playing together and the juniors and the amateurs being involved and all abilities. That's been fantastic. But we had a real lull in Australian golf for a long time there, didn't we? We went from 20 tournaments a year to three.
Well, what Kildus was the evolving PGA Tour in America. All of a sudden, they never played in November, December, or January. They had that was their time off, and so all the good players in the world came down here and supported us. And they'd come down because Greg had asked them to, or Gailey had asked them to, or Shears had you know come down and spend Christmas at our place. You know, that was the sort of the carrot, and they all wanted to play the Sandbelt. And then the Tiger started his tournament and a number of other tournaments started. And, all of a sudden, the PGA Tour were playing in Hawaii in July, in January and, right through to Christmas. And so we struggled to get the good players through. And the other factor was, of course, the media. All of a sudden we could watch the best players in the world 52 weeks of the year, basically. You'd stay home on a Monday morning and watch, Jack Nicklaus and Tiger and these guys playing in America. So it definitely had a dramatic effect on our ability to get sponsors and to get players down here.
It was a perfect storm in many ways, wasn't it? And I guess one of the things at the centre of it is appearance money. We know Peter Thompson was always anti-appearance money. I don't think he ever took any appearance money himself, though he would have no doubt been off it. Where do you stand on appearance money? It's a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? And without it, you're not going to get the top players anymore.
Well, look... If you come from the point of view that they are professional sportsmen there to make money and to feed families, then it's a lot easier to cope with. I remember in the days when we had the ANZ Championship, or so, Greg was asking $300,000. He was the first to really ask appearance money. He was asking for $300,000 and... they might be playing for $300,000. The prize money would be $300,000. Greg was getting his money. And I remember Terry Gale saying to me, I said to him, Terry, you've got to be more aggressive out on the thing. And he said, well, I'm not Greg Norman. And I said, the 15th hole at Metropolitan, that short par four that.
Around the corner there, yeah.
Was it the 16th? 16th. He said, you know, Greg would stand on the tee and crash it over the trees and go for the green. He said, I had to lay up here and come in because Greg had $300 in his pocket before we teed up. Mm. I'm fighting to feed a family and pay mortgages and all the along with the rest of the field.
Mm.
So, but without it, we wouldn't have had Greg Norman here every week. He was a great supporter of Australian golf, but he was also the first of the big appearance money of that era. Tiger, in 2009, I was lucky enough to be the tournament director of that one. And what a week that was. I mean, we'd sold it out 3 or 4 or 5 months beforehand, and Tiger reportedly got $3 million to turn up. And $3 million was probably the cheap budget for most of the thing, but it was
cheap for him, wasn't it? Because he made that return on investment comfortably. And then we had Dan Andrews on another podcast that I do a few weeks ago, and he said they comfortably got their money back and more on that.
Well, he was just a superstar.
Yeah. Of course, one of the things that happened there, Langers, is that because Tiger was worth $3 million and he was actually worth it, everyone else thought they were worth $2 million, but they weren't, were they?
No. No, there's only about 3 or 4 players that actually
move the needle. I think the kids say.
Yeah. Yeah, move the needle. That's the expression.
Who are?
Well, Seve did, Tiger did, Greg definitely did, and then there were lesser lights, Rory Wood.
Just a but tier then, below, isn't he, though? He does.
Yeah,
just a tier just below a Tiger and Norman and
Seve. Correct. That's very true. And then you had the Poulters of the world and these fellas that came through, and they're asking, you know, $1 million. Jim Furyk was asking $1 million. Well, gee, we'd go along to the tournament. I remember, I'll give you a good example, I think it was the Johnny Walker we had up in Queensland. And they had an unbelievable, well, Colin Montgomery was one of the big, number two in the world, huge, successful player. And I went out there one day and he had 4 people following him. Well, you know, is he worth $2 million?
No. Whereas Fred Couples, I think, played that same tournament with
correct.
With Peter Lonard tells a great story about playing with Couples. Oh, that was at the Masters. We won't go there. He told it on this podcast some time ago. So what is it, Langers? You've seen them all up close. What's the difference between Tiger and Greg and Seve and a terrific player like Couples, or Couples probably not so much, but Montgomery's a prime example, isn't he? Fabulous golfer, incredible golfer to watch. No one's interested in watching him. And Faldo probably a little bit the same.
Well, I've been incredibly lucky to get the job I had. I mean, it wasn't a job for me. It was a labour of love. And the years went,
let's not oversell that you did get paid. Like,
I do not want to upset Gavin Kirkman here, but I would have done it for nothing.
That's exactly right. And he'll be coming and asking for the money back if you're not careful.
I was recently talking at a golf club in Bowen Heads, actually, and someone said, "Have you enjoyed your life?" And I said, "I saw 35 different countries playing golf. I went to 35 different countries. I met 5 US presidents. I had a one-on-one with Mandela for 40 minutes. I danced with Princess Di. I had Prince Andrew sitting in my cart for half an hour telling me about mummy. And, I did the first Olympics in Rio. It wasn't a job. It was just
not bad for a talentless bloke who plays off 10 from suburban Melbourne, is it?
When you look back. Get down to 5.
But, I bet that changed once you started working in golf too. You would have gone out straight out to 10.
Well, I hated playing golf.
Yeah.
The last place in the world I wanted to go when I got away from work was go and play golf.
And especially, Langers, when you spend your life surrounded by people who can actually play. And you had a front row seat to the very best golf that's ever been played. It's quite emasculating, isn't it, when you realise just how poor you are?
I remember Terry Gale once, and his name keeps popping up, but he was such an important part of Australian golf. He and Graham Marsh really did set up this whole tour thing that we've got now. But I remember Terry Gale saying to me once, "You should not even bother or consider going to tour school unless you can shoot 65 four or five times a year on courses other than your own."
I've never seen, that's right.
And, you know, that was always the yardstick. I went to the Asian Amateur the other day at Royal Melbourne over the road here. Mm. Fantastic event. Wonderful. Well, and what an opportunity for the kids.
Best event of the year so far, I think.
But at the end of the day, I think one over par. Well, each of those, if they've all got aspirations of becoming professional, they've got to improve their game by about 10 shots.
Absolutely. And if you watch that golf, it was staggering.
It was wonderful golf.
Amazing play. The young Chinese fellow, Samson Zhang, on the Saturday when he shot 65, that was an extraordinary round of golf.
Well, everyone's talking about that. They compared it to any else of 60.
Yeah, very much so. And of course,
lucky enough,
the difference being, of course, as he shot 75 the next day. Touring pro doesn't do that, does he?
No.
65-70, but not 65-75.
No. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so it's a different thing. Who have been some of those best players? Oh, so we were back on the – so what is it about the players that do attract the attention? What's the difference between Tiger and Montgomery? There's a physical difference, clearly, and the results say it, but
– well, at that, I was getting to a point with that Bowen Heads luncheon. Someone said to me, "Well, what makes these guys such an attraction?" And I said, "Well, in my life, I think I've met 5 people who actually tip the scale." I said, "You know, what is charisma? What is your definition of charisma?" And I said, "Norman had it. Mm-hmm. Seve had it. Bill Clinton had it."
Oh, very much, yeah.
Princess Di had it. Mm-hmm. Mandela had it. And other than that, I don't think I've ever met anyone else that had that walk into the room. I'll tell you a story with Norman. So we're playing at Huntingdale in the Masters. He's coming up the 9th fairway. All our best players are either going down 1 or going down 10. And they've just teed off on 1 and they've just teed off 10 as Greg comes up the middle walking towards the 9th green. And I was with Trevor Hurdon and I said, "Trevor, have a look at this." And he said, "What?" He said, "These guys, they've stopped. And those guys, they've stopped. They used to stop in the fairway and just watch Greg walk."
The other players.
The other players. And we're talking about, you know, world-class players. Mm. They used to stop and watch him walk. He wasn't hitting a shot. He just had that charisma, whatever that is.
It's like an invisible force field, isn't it? You have a physiological reaction, because I had a similar thing. Before the Olympics, he was going to carry the torch one, and they did an event in Sydney. It might have been a preview for his own tournament that he had, the Holden Classic he had for a while up at the Lakes. And it was around the Olympics time. So they had this big press thing in the down on the harbour somewhere. Anyway, he was coming from the Connaught Hotel where he was staying, and he'd just done a live interview on the stage. There's about 300 of us in this room, including all these Olympic dignitaries, like really important, successful people. So we're all there waiting. We watched him on the big TV on the Today Show, and he's going to arrive soon. And you knew he'd arrive, not because you saw him, but the room went quiet, like a Mexican wave through the room. He'd walk through the door, and people just stopped. It was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. And these are people, like you were saying, players who you can't impress a tour pro. It's impossible. No, doesn't matter what you do. They don't stop and watch anybody.
No, that's exactly right.
But they'd stop to watch him. And I remember I was staggered by that. And you could feel this. Oh, Greg. And you turned around. Like, oh, that's what it's about. He's here. And he sort of walked through the room. And that'd be an extraordinary way to live, wouldn't it?
In 1986, it was explained to me. In 1986, Greg Norman was the most recognisable face in the world. That included the Pope, the Queen, Princess Di, and the President of the US. Because everyone in the world knew Greg Norman. They played golf everywhere, whereas they didn't necessarily know in the outbacks of Africa
who Michael Jordan might have been, but Greg Norman you'd seen somewhere.
Well, I don't think we should put Jordan in there because
he might be pretty recognisable too.
Yeah.
He's funny, Norman, isn't he, in that? His incredible presence and charisma is as much built on that didn't quite get there as Tiger's is built on that never failed to get there.
Yeah.
They're two sides of the same coin, aren't they?
It's such a sad thing. I mean, if the Persimmon driver had not been superseded by the Metal Woods, I have no doubt Greg would have won 10 or 11 majors. He was so far above anyone else with those wooden woods, but then everyone else came up to his level, and then it became a mind game with him. And
now all those kids that were out there last week, they hit it 50 yards further than Norman ever did in his prime. And
correct.
It sort of compressed everything.
Well, I remember the first time Greg, the 17th hole, I was talking about it with Mike Clayton last week. We were walking up the 17th hole at Royal Melbourne, and I said, "You remember the first time Norman hit driver off the deck here and got home? Now they're hitting 5 irons to the same green, and the tee's probably back another 30 meters,
another 30 yards back from what it used to be." It was an extraordinary thing, wasn't it, to see Norman in full flight? We had Tony Johnston on this podcast a couple of years ago, and he regarded the story of the first time he played with Norman. Him and the guy who's playing with him, they'd heard of it. Oh, is this Norman? We're playing there. We'll see how good he is. He said they got to the first tee. And he was just rifling around for something in his bag when Norman hit off. And he said, then this gunshot went off. I was like, what happened there? He turned around. It was Norman hitting. He said he'd never heard a sound like it. Professional golfer of several years' experience. He's like, he'd never seen anything like it. Just we forget that, don't we? And everybody's the same. I think everybody's the same who lived through that era. You still can't believe that he didn't win 10 majors. Even though you know the outcome, you watch those majors again, well, he's going to win this. Yeah. You know he doesn't, but he's got to win this. He can't not win it from here. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. I bet Greg would change history if he could, but in the wash of it all, that's part of the Greg Norman story.
And
I've been lucky enough to do 15 Masters, and they still talk about him, about each and every one of those ones that he didn't win, you know, what happened and, you know, this, that. It's the legend of Norman.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, of course, he's still, to this day, you wonder what effect that's had on his personality. He still seems to need the limelight well into his career that he had then. You'd imagine it could be addictive. It could drive you into becoming a hermit, or you could feed off it. And I think he was one that fed off it, and we still see him today being very high profile. Who were the best players, and who are the best players you've seen, and some of the best shots? You've had a front row seat to some pretty amazing golf.
One day stands out for me with the Australian when Laufebel and Norman played together. And I think they shot, in the first six holes, they shot one eagle and 11 birdies.
Wow.
It was just mind boggling. That second hole at the Australian's about 200 metres, and they both hit it inside 3 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how good they were. And that's the other thing that staggers me about these guys. When I could play, you know, as a single figure player, I'd have a birdie and then I'd have three pars and a birdie and can I hang on to the ninth? You know, and try and be even par by the, these guys just went birdie, 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 birdie. You know, it was like a avalanche coming.
It's a different bubble to that zone.
I remember that
event too. I think Norman got the upper hand there, which was There's a fabulous photo of him on the 18th green raising the putter with the Australian flag in the background.
Yeah,
I know the guy who took it.
But that's Norman was exceptional. Tiger, well, I was lucky enough to have a bit to do with Tiger, both at here in Australia and at various President's Cup. I refereed him 3 or 4 times in President's Cups and, I mean, he hit shots that you just can't believe. The last President's Cup at Royal Melbourne again, he played Answer in the last round in the singles. Answer had made the mistake of saying, "Oh, I'd love to take on Tiger." And so Tiger said, "I'll give you the chance, son." And then, but I refereed that match, and as the referee, you're allowed to walk on the green and down the middle of the fairways. And it finished on the 16th hole, and it was the most embarrassing finish because Tiger holds a 30-footer and just walks straight over and gives me a high five. Well, the rules official isn't meant to be giving players high five, especially when you're meant to be independent. But it was quite a memorable. But those 16 holes, he played 16 of them, and on 16 occasions, he was 8 foot directly under the hole with an uphill putt. It was ridiculous. I mean, anyone that's played Royal Melbourne knows how undulating those greens are. Where he left the ball that day was just amazing. Every putt was just straight uphill.
I was here too. The President's Cup's so big that even as media, you can't get inside the ropes a lot of the time with the President's Cup, and I was outside the ropes. But it was a privilege to watch him, I thought, in 2019. That might be the best golf I've seen in the life, but it was a privilege to be here for that. That was a masterclass.
It was, and I was also lucky, and everything comes back to Royal Melbourne. I wonder why. I suppose because we have all our big tournaments there, but I watched every shot of Ernie L's 60 at Royal Melbourne, and that was the same deal. Every putt was 10 foot straight uphill, you know, blokes like you and I would have got, but he left the ball where it needed to be left.
That's the skill, isn't it?
And, it's the 17th of the... what is it? The West Course, the par four round the corner.
Oh, the ninth of the composite, I think it is. Yes.
The other one. Next hole, the ninth, tenth, the 11th of the old composite. They've confused me.
But anyway.
But he drove it through the fairway into the trees, and he couldn't quite cut it enough to get it on, and he made bogey. So to shoot 60 with a bogey was just unbelievable golf.
I'm sure he still thinks about that sometimes.
He probably does.
That would be taunting him.
He probably does.
Taunting him. I heard Norman once say, I've certainly read the quote and it's been attributed to him, though I'm sure others have said it, that the difference between a 20 marker and a scratch marker is not as big as the difference between a scratch marker and a touring professional. You've seen it all. Would you go along with that?
Definitely. Definitely. I look at the courses just the way they're set up. I mean, people say, we had 3 blokes shoot par here. There wouldn't have been too many amateurs that would shoot. They proved it in the Asian Amateur on Saturday. They didn't shoot par. To compare that to what Ernie Els did, given that it was set up on tournament conditions, rock hard, plenty of run, the ball had run into the trees and all. It's just the amateur game is so far away from the professional game, it's a joke.
You probably laugh at this time. I'm sure you haven't had a lot to do with women's golf, probably maybe a little bit later in your career when there's been a bit more of the two playing. It's not uncommon to stumble across on Twitter idiots who are playing off scratch. Well, probably less scratch ones. 4 markers tend to be them. I reckon they could compete on the LPGA.
No, not.
It's,
well, there's a very good argument for saying Carey's our best player ever.
I would agree with that.
And
has done more for the game in this country post her playing career than most, yeah. I would suggest to.
Now, I can give you an example. As I said, I played off 4-5 at my best, and I remember playing with Jessica Corder. She was out here, and I was lucky enough to be playing with her. She drove at 70 metres past me. I mean, I couldn't, you know, I was hitting it all right, but she was so good. Women's golf is very, very good. Mm. It's not as good as the men's game.
No,
but
it's way better than most people think, though.
It is way better than, and I would love to back them in. Once you get on the green, their putting is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're very good on the greens.
Where's golf now, Langers? Globally and here in Australia, what's your feeling about it? You've seen ups and downs locally and globally. Yeah.
Well, I was a disciple of Peter Thompson. I mean, Tomo was fantastic. He was for me. He was a mentor of mine. I could always go and ask him if I had a problem or a thing. And Tomo, I can remember him saying to me back in 2000. Say, he said, professional golf should be 54 holes. It should be 18 holes, flip the draw, 18 holes, and the top 30 play off on Sunday or Saturday, whatever day you want to have the last day. Other than that, the majors and the national opens should be as they are at the moment, 54 holes. But
72 holes, you
mean? 72 holes. So I think the LIV boys have probably got it right because there is just too much golf. And I think we're killing our own product by having so much golf. I think it needs to be a little bit shorter and it needs to be probably a little bit quicker. But people used to say to me, why is it so slow? Well, the reason it's so slow is because the fields have got 156 or 144 in the field. And if you think about it, that's 2 hours or 2 hours 10 worth of tee times off the first tee and the 10th tee. So the first guy off the first, there's no point in him playing quicker than 2 hours and 20 minutes.
He's only going to hit the cue on the 10th tee.
He's going to hit the cue on the 10th tee. So, and, you know, obviously there's a little bit of flow back through the field if there's a lost ball or whatever. So rounds end up being 5 hours.
What an extraordinary sport, Langers, where the most important piece of equipment can be lost at any time. Can you imagine that in any other sport? Yeah. The single most important piece of equipment at any time can just be lost. Yeah. You have to replace it with another one.
I never thought of it like that, but it's
staggering, yeah. Isn't it? Well, let's talk about the rules. You were a rules official, of course, and I'll ask you about some of the incidents and things that you've seen. But you often hear amateurs, and particularly people who are newish to the game, this frustration. Surely the rules don't need to be this complex. But they do, don't they? Golf is the single most complex of any organized pursuit that humans undertake, I reckon.
Well, a number of years ago, before the R&A, I sat down with a couple of mates and we tried to simplify it.
Mm.
And it's impossible.
Of course it is.
It's impossible. I get people, the most common one I get is, oh, surely divots should be ground under repair.
You had to do it, didn't you?
and I'd say to them, well, what is a divot? Mm. I mean, is a divot just a bad lie or is a divot something that was caused 2 weeks ago, or is it?
When does it stop being a divot?
When does it stop being a divot? And that just explains to me the difficulty of golf. There's so many scenarios and every rule's the same. You know, when do you get relief? When don't you get relief? And I think they've done a wonderful job in simplifying it a little bit or making it more consistent when they did the review recently.
4 years ago. Yeah. The big one. Now, I'm sure you will join with me, just to take a quick side, I'm sure you'll join with me and most golfers, Langers, at protesting the notion that we've lost hazards and matches that are square. The language changes have not been for the better, I don't think.
No, a penalty area. I struggled with that.
Yeah, of course.
I think we struggled all with that, but we're of the generation. But keep in mind, all the young blokes coming through, it'll never be anything but penalty areas and matches all square.
I'd agree with it, except that in Australia, I don't care how old you are, you still look at putts in feet. Nobody says, oh, I had a 1.2 meter of a par. No, you had a 6 footer. It makes sense. Yeah, yards are a bit the same, but meters you can understand. But nobody's converted to meters for putts. It just doesn't happen. So
no, it does not. It's a funny old game. I still play in yards.
Yeah,
because I can't walk a meter.
Oh, okay. Your gait doesn't.
Yeah,
isn't metric.
It's not metric. But now that we've got the lasers and that
watch that tells the watch, you where you are in the.
It's not so difficult.
Calling all golf legends. Let's tee off for a cancer-free future this December. Cancer Council's The Longest Day is the ultimate golf challenge, where you'll play 4 rounds of golf in one day to support people impacted by cancer. Almost 1 in 2 Australians will be diagnosed with cancer before the age of 85. By working together, we can all play a part in reducing the impact of cancer for all Australians. Have you got what it takes? Grab your mates and register now at thelongestday.org.au and let's tackle cancer together.
Speaking of the complexity, you would have seen some bizarre rules over your time. Are there any that spring to mind of incidents on tournaments, because particularly golf tournaments, with all of the infrastructure that goes with it and whatnot, throws up some people hitting it into spectators' pockets. There's all sorts of things.
Well, the two that come to mind, I had a disaster. Well, it wasn't a disaster. As it turned out, it was quite humorous. I was at the New Zealand Open, and Nicholas Fast, we were playing at Gulf Harbour.
The greatest misnomer in history, by the way, Nicholas Fast.
You're not wrong. And I must say this about Nicholas, lovely fellow.
Lovely bloke.
But no sense of humour at all.
And, plays golf for a living.
Well, that's right. And in all fairness, I'll explain what happened. So he hit the ball through the green. It took one bounce and it landed in this lovely young lady's lap. And she froze. She just sat there and the ball's sitting in her lap. And I got called along to do the ruling. And I said, well, Nicholas, we've got a couple of options here. You can, we can mark a spot directly underneath, move the lady in there. You can take an unplayable. I don't think you're going to do that. You can go back and play where. So I went through the options. I said, but you also have the option of playing it as it lies. And the TV camera's right there and he's looking at me and I said, but if you choose that option, I'm sure this young lady would appreciate you taking a very shallow divot. Well, this is not funny. This is, I tried to win tournament, you know. And I thought, oh, I've picked the wrong fella. Yeah, this is rather embarrassing. So it was a bit awkward, but if it had been one of the Australian boys, they would have pulled out the wedge exactly or the driver or something, and they would have been taking practice swings.
What was the look on her face? Because yeah. She'd have had no idea, I'm sure.
Well, everyone around laughed, but Nicholas didn't think it was too humorous. So anyway, he went on and won the tournament, so that was the byline to it. But probably my worst two moments, and I had plenty. They say that there's only two types of rules official, those that have made a stake and those that are going
to. They're about to, that's right.
Yeah, so because the rules are such that a lot of it is.
And change too.
Yeah.
You just get a handle on the most complex rules and suddenly there's a slight shift which changes everything. So
that's exactly right. But look, first of all, I'll touch on that. You know, we have a network where I can ring Simon Migdolski from Golf Australia if it's an unusual one. The great John Paramore in Europe, I used to ring John 3 or 4 times a year. Or even they'd ring us to get our opinion on it. So there was a network of rules officials around the world. Ring the R&A. David Rickman was fantastic. And
just to,
Grant
to
Moyer.
Just to listen to his accent and his voice, David Rickman. Fantastic. He could have been a voice actor. He's fabulous.
Just wonderful. But we all had this network that we could rely on. And many a time I rang John Paramore at 3 in the morning, much to his disgust, but because of the time differences, but we normally got to the right answer, I think, eventually. And you talk about rules. I remember one day at Huntingdale, we had a co-sanctioned event with Europe, but it was the same week that the World Cup was on in Malaysia. and a player took a drop away from a flagpole and then, in playing the shot, hit the flagpole with his club.
Mm-hmm.
And I was of the opinion that it was a penalty.
Not complete relief.
Not complete relief. The European tour guy that was out here at the time said, no, he changed his intended shot that he'd taken relief from. Instead of bump and running, he was now going to flop it. And so by taking a different approach to how he played it, he's exempt from the fact that he hasn't taken. Wow. So I sent it up to Malaysia. I rang Paramore and Rickman, who were at the World Cup. And there were 12 of the best rules officials in the world there, and it came back 6-6.
What a dinner that must have been that night.
It came back 6-6. So, you know, sometimes there isn't a correct answer.
Yeah.
It's just an opinion, and that's the way.
So did you get your way? Did you dish out the shot?
No, I didn't. I went soft as usual, yeah.
I think Kari endured something similar, did she not? She was playing an event that was co-sanctioned. Under the co-sanctioning tour's rules, you couldn't brush sand off the grass on the green, but under the LPGA rules, you could, and she's just in the habit of. I'm sure it happened to her. I'm sure it was in a bunker and brushing sand or something, but it was a two-tour thing where one tour played by this rule and the other tour played by that. It's like if you're a player and you play amongst different tours, that's a tough gig week in, week out, isn't it?
Well, at the time, the biggest event we had in the world, I think, was the Johnny Walker. It was in Bali, and Nick Feldo picked up a bit of coral out of the bunker.
That's right, yes.
And under our rules, because we were playing under our rules, you couldn't touch loose impediments in the... But under European rules, he was entitled to move it. And because of it, he ended up being – he led by four or five shots with three holes to go and got disqualified because he signed for a wrong card 3 days earlier.
If only he managed to do that at the Masters in 96, the world might be a different place.
That's true. That's very true. My worst moment and, my two worst moments, we can talk about the tie at Coolum in 2002
mm-hmm.
between Lonard and Mosley. But let's talk about the worst moment I had was definitely at the Open Championship. And the week started with the R&A not having a good week with pin placements in the qualifying, and they got slaughtered in the press. And then on the Wednesday, they have the media dinner for the world media. And the chairman of the, who was a well-known barrister, gave a wonderful oration about golf and everything else. But he finished it off with a joke about a yank, a pom, and a nip. And nip apparently is very, very offensive to the Japanese. So the next day it was headlines up there, racist organisation, shouldn't be. So they'd had a terrible start. And then on the first round, Tiger Woods hit his ball onto these power cables. And as is the case with Tiger, there's 10,000 people following. The chances of moving the cables are negligible. And so the rules official decided, well, I'm going to let him drop it just to the side. He gained nothing, but he dropped it to the side. Anyway, one of the TV guys got onto it and said, oh, there's one set of rules for Tiger Woods and another for the rest of the field. This is what should have happened. He should have moved the cables and dropped it in the... Anyway, so the next day, and this is where I get to the story, real story, I've got Phil Mickelson, who's the number two player in the world. And on the second hole, he hits it right of the green and it goes straight into the bank and disappears. So we look for 4 minutes and 52 seconds. He had 5 minutes in those days. And some lady, I'll never forgive her, says, oh, there's one here. So we, Phil and I walk over and he said, can I mark it and see that's mine? Yeah, Phil, that's fine. So he marks it, he picks it up. Yep, that's it. And because it's embedded, it's gone straight in. He says, nearest point. And I said, yep, Phil, that's fine. And so he drops it. And as it leaves his hand, I say
to myself, hang on a minute.
Wait on. 51 weeks of the year, we play embedded ball through the green. But this particular week, the only week in the year at the Open Championship, we play closely mown surfaces only. And the reason for that is because at all our tournament venues, there's trucks and TV and crowds, and you get pretty ordinary ground. Anyway, I said, well, just hold on, Phil. Before you hit that, I just want to check. I said, Phil, I'm sorry, mate. You're going to have to put it back into the pitch mark. We're not playing through the green. And Bones, who we all know is from his TV commentary, was catting for Phil, and he said, oh, you've already given the ruling. I'm not going to take that. He's going to be able to play it. No, I said, look, Bones, just settle down, mate. Unfortunately, there is another rule in the book that says if I recognise I've made a mistake, I can fix it. And keep in mind, there's only 300 million people watching it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not
going to... And, of course, it's the most interesting thing happening on the golf course too. Whenever there's a rules thing that starts to brew, now we all want to... It's like a fight in a schoolyard, isn't it?
Well, it is. And so the cameras come in and I said, look, Phil, you're going to have to put it back into this pitch mark. And he was great. He said, yep, okay. So he puts it, he said, well, I'm going to have to take an unplayable. What are my options? So I ran through it. Now, if you can imagine the green at being at this level, the next tee is 25 feet above it, off to the right.
What was this?
And it was at Carnoustie. And there's a path leading up the hill to the next tee, and it's almost on a 45-degree angle. It's quite steep. Anyway, Phil measures two club lengths and it gets him just to this path. So he drops it on the path and it rolls forward. So he drops it again and it rolls forward. So now we place it. So he places it on the path and I'm thinking, thank God, that's over. I'm getting out of here. So I head up to the next tee. Phil goes down onto the green. And anyway, this ball, after about 30 seconds, decides it's going to follow Phil down to the green. And it rolled probably 8-10 metres down this hill and spills out onto the green, and now it's about 20 feet from the pin. And I'm looking at Phil, and Phil looked, and he said, well, what do? I replace it? And I said, well, no, Phil. I said, the ball was in play. We now play it from the new position.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't caused it to move. And he said, what, I put it from here on the green? I said, yeah, Phil, that's – and I'm thinking, TV, you're never going to understand this. They've seen me, you know, it's lost, it's 4 minutes 52, it's embedded and it's thing, and I've buggered that up and now I've dropped him here and now it's on the – and now this dumb fat Aussie rules official from Australia is going to let him putt it from out in the middle of the green. So anyway, thank God he missed it and thank God he shot 76 and missed the cut. But at the end of the day, David Rickman, to show the class of David Rickman, said, met me on 18 and I'm feeling terrible, you know, after the week they've already had. And so I said, look, David, I'm sorry. He said, sorry? You've saved the Open. And I said, what? He said, if you'd let him play it from where he dropped it originally, he would hit it to 2 feet, hold the putt and gone on and won the championship. He said, by the fact that you had the courage to make him put it back in the thing, you know, you've saved the Open. And I thought, Rickman, you are the best bloke I've ever known. He was fantastic. I thought it might have been my last, but I ended up doing another 10 or 12 after that.
You mentioned John Paramore, and if there is such a thing, he was a giant in the rules game. He was on this podcast, and what a fabulous storyteller and humor. We lost John last year, yes. Sadly, which I'm sure was particularly sad for you. He talked about the relationship with the players being mostly good, but it can't be all good, can it? He recounted a fabulous story with JB Holmes where it ended with Paramore walking away saying QED. There was a mathematical discussion and Holmes didn't get the drop. How have you found the relationship with the players? As you said, early on it's a travelling circus. You kind of all have to get along, but like a marriage, Langers, that doesn't mean it's always happy and fun, does it?
No. Look, pressure does funny things to people, including rules officials. Some people handle it. Some people don't handle it as well. And relationships is really what it becomes. And I feel sorry for everyone we recruit to do rules. It becomes, you know, difficult for them if they don't know the player and the player doesn't know them. And I'll give you an example of this in a minute. But the interesting to give you an idea, John was a master of people skills and
big bear of a man too, which bear. I think really worked in his favour. He was an imposing figure. He wasn't one to be pushed around or
correct. Yeah. And I remember one day at Lake Carenup, Paul Casey, a very good player, well known. He was one of their top players before he went to America. Hit it onto this dirt path, and he claimed he was in a wheel rut on the dirt path. And I happened to be the nearest official, and I said, "Look, Paul, I'm sorry." And I knew him quite well because over the years I'd done a few things with him and been out to dinner with him. I said, "Paul, really, mate, I'm sorry, but it's a pretty faint. Well, you're going to have to play it." And we discussed it earlier in the week, and we decided anyone that was here would, it was an integral part and you had to play. And I could see he was agitated. And in over my earpiece, John Paramore was in the lunchroom getting some lunch. And John comes over and says, "I've just seen it on television. You're right. I would have made him play it too." And I thought, this might give Case a bit of, you know, a bit of comfort. That
it'll help my case and he'll feel better.
Well, that he's not being done by this Aussie rules official. So I said, "Look, JP's watching it in the lunchroom and he's just seen the ball and he reckons he would have made you play it as well if that makes you feel any better." And he said, "He's watching in the lunchroom." And with that, he walks straight over to the camera. He fronts the camera from about 3 feet. And he said, "Paramore, get out of here. You're fat enough as it is without feeding your face in the players' lounge." Straight down the lens of the camera. Well, everyone in the world saw this, and we all laughed, but I don't think John thought it was all that humorous. But that was the relationship he had with Casey was that Casey could get away with it.
He could give any ruling. Paramore. He had that standard. The players would just always bow and say, "Well, if that's what Paramore said," and they'd argue with other rules officials, but not with him, would they?
Well, with John, I mean, you keep in mind David Rickman, Grant Moyer from the RNA, Andy McPhee, John Paramore, and probably Mike Shea and Mark Russell in America, those six wrote the rule book.
Yeah.
So
professional golf and all of its complexities.
Yeah, so they understood it and they knew the reasons behind why rules were there, and so players were pretty gutsy if they took one of those six on. Yeah, and
you'd really need to know your stuff, wouldn't you? Yeah. None of them would be keen to take each other on. So if you're a player, you'd want to think twice before you might do that.
But and the relationship with the players is important. I got trotted out to do the Warrigal Super 6 last year, which I'm going down to do next week because I've got a bit of
Because you're retired now, aren't you? You've got time to go and do golf tournaments.
I know. So Graham Scott had taken over from me, and Graham was the tournament director, and it's raining and the players are all wondering, are we coming off the course? Are we not coming off the course? And I get called by this young Western Australian pro. I still can't remember his name. He was a new fella on the tour to the ninth green. And he said, "I'm not putting this. Look, it's a puddle." And I said, "Look, until the siren goes, you've got to keep playing. You can squeegee it and you can get." And he says, "Listen, Grandpa, go find me a rules official that knows something about the game, will you?" And I thought, times have changed. Time to move on. And I just burst out laughing and rang Graham. I said, "Can we get a second opinion here on the ninth?"
Preferably from somebody young.
You feather dusted and.
I went looking for some photos, Langers, because we have to have photos here, and I'm going to take your picture after we finish this because we'll need a photo to go with the piece. And I found a fabulous photo of you sitting in a golf cart at the Australian Open at New South Wales Golf Club in 2009, surrounded by Nathan Green, Peter O'Malley, Matthew Goggin, and one other who I can't remember. And there's an awful lot of pointing going on. And
that was Ogilvy.
Ogilvy, that's right. Remonstrating with you, I suspect. Tell us what, because that 2009 Open was a difficult one rules-wise, and Adam Scott went on to win it. And yeah, it was a fabulous tournament. It had a fabulous venue, but it can get windy there.
Trevor Herdon was the tournament director. We were there as guests of Golf Australia or the AGU. And we'd had discussions with the club early in the week about how hard and fast the greens were. Trevor and I didn't think that they were possibly where they should have been for the tournament. And we were informed that, we were informed that they play it a lot harder and faster on monthly medal days than this.
You wouldn't have heard that ever in your career,
never,
would you, previously?
Never. Every club. And we explained, look, we've got 4 days. We have to finish the tournament. We can't afford. Anyway, gets to the Saturday, was it, or the Friday?
I think it was
Friday, it might have been.
Either or, yeah.
And their famous 10, 11, 12.
15
up the hill.
Which is a brutal golf hole in no wind.
Yeah, at Peter O'Malley, and it always seemed to be Peter O'Malley. He was responsible at Royal Melbourne. He was responsible at Moona.
Moona, yeah. Was he here at Victoria when it happened there?
I don't think it. I think
he would have been
somewhere.
Yeah. He'd have been within a hole.
Yeah.
He's a troublemaker. World's nicest bloke, but he's a troublemaker.
Every time we suspended him for an Australian Open, he was the catalyst. Anyway, he'd hit this putt and it lipped out and finished 20 feet away. And I said, well, guys, you know, we're not going to be playing. And then the cameramen come from everywhere. So, you know, because that's where the incident is.
Journos love it and photographers love it. They can sniff a controversy a mile away, Langers.
And the players love it too.
Of course they do.
Now, not one of those four were blaming me or having a go at me, but I remember Ogilvy says, hey, here's the cameras. Quick, let's give it to him. So they all start pointing at me. So it was quite a contrived sense of humour by the players, that rather than actually they weren't that disappointed. And
you need those moments, don't you? You need that relationship. For the whole thing to continue going like a well-oiled machine, you have to be able to have that sort of thing sometimes.
Well, I said the most difficult or the most important part of any tournament for me, and I was lucky enough to be director of tournaments for 20-odd years, was the medical room. And we had a wonderful medical team, all very highly qualified, but all very good psychologists, amateur psychologists.
Like hairdressers, were they?
Yeah. And look, when you've got a field of 180 players playing throughout the season, some are going to have financial problems, some are going to have marital problems, some are girlfriend problems, some are going to have all these sort of issues, and for whatever reason, the outpouring of those issues was always the medical team, and the medical team would always keep me informed as to why or who was struggling, and, you know.
So you could be sensitive to.
Or sometimes you'd see an explosion on course and you think, that's not him. You know, that's just not him. I reckon at least 3 or 4 times I had one of the medical team escort one of our players who we were worried about almost suicide.
Wow.
To the airport to get him onto a plane, knowing that their parents would be at the other end to pick him up. And it was never the, you know, the Greg Normans or the Lonards. Or it was always young blokes that were struggling. And
in some ways that's more important, isn't it, Langers? What we don't do a terrific job in golf historically, professionally, is looking after the you probably make this case both ways, don't you? We've agreed earlier there's too much golf and too many professional golfers. That's a reality. But by the same token, it's a horribly pressure-filled life if you're not doing well. John Paramore told the story about a young guy he encountered who was just blatantly caught cheating. He said he understood why it had happened.
Yeah.
Because the guy had no money and he was trying to live up to a whole bunch of things. Yeah. You see some really – golf can drive people mad, can't it, literally?
Well, yeah, because it's professional golf and the whole thing's driven by money, there's going to be times where people do things that they regret later on, and they're not bad people. They're just the moment's caught them and then there's no going back. Yeah. And the one thing that fellow players will never forgive is a player that's caught or accused of cheating. And sometimes we can't disqualify through lack of evidence or whatever, but the players don't forget. And
they get ostracised.
Do they ever?
How much cheating does go on, Langers, do you reckon?
Oh, I think we're naive if we think that it doesn't happen, but I would like to think that 99.9, the number of players that have come to me and said, oh, I broke a twig on a branch in a trees when no one else was there, but I'm just calling two shots on myself, or I'm calling this, or I'm doing that. The number of times that happened to me way outweighed the number of times I heard someone say, oh, I reckon he moved the ball, or he improved his lie, or he fudged it on the green. I mean, it did happen, but over 20 odd years, we're talking a handful rather than.
Players who do that are not likely to be successful players either, though, are they? You know, if you feel like you need to, you rarely get a player of any great caliber where there's any that sort of, there's a couple, but where there's that sort of stench hanging around them. It's pretty rare, isn't it?
Oh, very rare. Very rare. Most of the good players in the world love the game of golf more than they love themselves, and they respect the game and they respect the history of the game and they treat it accordingly. They treat it as if it was one of their kids.
Yeah.
It's such a fantastic game to be part of.
I think all of us and everyone listening will feel the same way about it. Do you think there's less of that now with the more money in the game? We're starting to see issues with gambling, integrity. We had a couple of players suspended from the PGA Tour last week.
Yeah. Well, look, I probably shouldn't be saying this.
Good, then say it. That's exactly what I want to hear.
Okay. Australians, the top Australian players are either playing on the PGA Tour, are playing in Asia, are playing in Europe, are playing in Japan, or are playing on the
Corn Ferry.
Corn Ferry.
Nike, Ben Hogan, take your pick. We'll call it the Corn Ferry.
So if you said there's 50 players around the world playing on those tours, they're probably our top 50 players. Mm-hmm. The question then has to be asked, what is the purpose of the Australian tour? Are we a feeder tour? Are we a tour in our own right that wants to be competing with the PGA Tour and Europe and DP World? Or are we a tour that's providing pathways for players to get to the main tours of the world? Now, depending on what the answer to that is, that question depends on my next thought. Because if we think we are a pathway tour, then the question has to be asked, well, to what depth do we need to provide opportunities for our best young golfers and golfers to progress?
You can have field sizes, is that the...
Well, yeah. So if you've got 50 already, our top 50 already playing and having opportunities, do we need to provide for another 50 or another 100 or another 150?
That's a question.
And to me, to provide the opportunity for Australia's top 150 is just unrealistic. There's not 150 world-class players in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there might be 50, and you never know who's going to develop and who's going to become.
We've all seen the can't miss kids that missed, and we've all seen the guys who didn't look like they were going to do anything who went on to succeed.
Yeah, Nick Ahern. Yeah. You know, was
number 16 in the world.
Yeah,
you watch Nick play, and he wouldn't mind hearing anybody say, you would never pick Nick Ahern as a world class player, and he is.
And he is, and he is. So, I used to have a constant battle with, my superiors in that. Because the PGA was a member organisation, they had to provide opportunities for their members.
It's the PGA Tour's problem.
It is.
By the players.
It's run by the players. But
the lunatics are in charge of the asylum in some ways.
Well,
that's a harsh way of saying it.
But if I always looked at it this way, by providing 100 professional golf is like a drug.
Mm.
As soon as you get the taste of it, you want more and you want more and you want more. But some of them aren't good enough. And so the number of kids that I saw run up debts of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 with no realistic chance of ever becoming a world-class player or going onto the international scene, I used to argue that fields in Australia should be no more than 78. I used to think we should have just
it's a very interesting idea, Langers. That wouldn't have made you popular with a lot of players, though some would have seen the sense.
Well, the senior blokes do understand that. The senior blokes do understand that. You know, you talk to the Lonards or the O'Malleys or the
They've been broke, haven't they, at some point?
Well, they have, but they understand that there's so many kids that are we're ruining a lot of marriages because mum's sitting at home, she's got a three-year-old kid, and dad wants to be playing professional golf and he's not making a cut. And we're giving him the opportunity to keep going and going and going. So it's a
tough one, isn't it?
It's, yeah, half a dozen.
Like all addictions, there's no simple answer.
Well, there is no simple answer. And you do want to provide opportunities, and that's where the PGA is fantastic. It does provide opportunities, but we also provide the opportunity for a lot of them to put themselves into a hole that they can't dig out of for another 5-10 years. And really, I got into a bit of trouble 1 year at tour school because I sat down and there were 40 cards given and I said, well, gentlemen, I want you to have a look around this room because in 2 years' time, there'll only be three of you left. And that's depressing to a kid that's just got his card. I said, because when you play Adam Scott, you're giving him 5-shot handicap start. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, Adam's going to be staying at Crown Casino. He's going to have his manager. He's having his wife. He's got the kids. He's got the nutritionist there. Most of you will be sharing a room somewhere or sleeping in a car or whatever. And I equate that to over a tournament of about 5 shots. And so, you know, the chances of success are not great unless you are exceptionally talented and work and get sponsorship and
get a bit lucky as well. Like
and get a lot lucky.
You've got to be a bit lucky as well. On the flip side of that, though, you don't want to stomp on people's dreams either, do you?
No.
So it's hard to say this. I mean, you're not going to be good enough. Who knows? They might.
No one knows who's good enough. And that's where the system does work.
It's the beauty of it. It's the ugliness of it all wrapped up into one. It's typical golf, isn't it? Because golf.
A number of players make it who probably shouldn't have. A number of players who should have. Players that were so talented just didn't have the financial backing to get there, and they don't make it. And
well, the right attitude. Sometimes we've all seen the guy who can hit amazing golf shots, just hasn't got the head for golf.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking the other day about I've had a blank. He won the NSSC or NCA.
James McLean. You've never seen a bloke hit a golf ball better than him.
How good was he?
But freakish.
Did his wrist, and that was basically the end of his career.
Michael Sims, similar, an injury Simi. Really did. He was Rookie of the Year on the PGA Tour.
Wonderful player.
Mm.
Wonderful player. But injuries come along, and it's like a footballer or anything else. There's all sorts of things can end a career when it's just blossoming.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of things I want to touch on before we finish up, because I've just noted how long we've been at it for. You mentioned the Sixers at Warragul. Sixers golf was kind of your idea, mm-hmm. the original one down at South. I think you even had a shot clock. Lay out for me how you wanted that whole thing to unfold, because you've shown there you've got some fairly radical ideas which deserve consideration about how professional golf maybe should look.
Yeah, well, It was this week about 7 or 8 years ago. I was sitting at home, didn't have a tournament on, and I was watching the Melbourne Cup Carnival. I'm on the couch, and I reckon that week I had $252 bets. And I thought,
You would never have a $500 bet, would you?
Oh, hell no.
No chance. No. You'd have $252 bets.
That's right. Especially with the money I got paid at the time.
That's exactly right. Kirkman, don't come looking for your money back.
Correct. So, and I had a great week, and I'm backing Quinellas, and I'm backing this, and I'm back. And I thought, maybe golf needs this so that the people at home have got an interest. There's no point, if you want to have a bet on golf, you have a bet on the Thursday morning or before they tee off, and you got to wait till
Sunday night. Unless your guy misses the cut, does the right thing by, and you can give up Friday night.
So I decided, well, what can we do to enable there to be 20 or 30 bets and a result every 5 minutes? And so I came up with the Super Six or the match play, and we had to try and get it to be a order of merit event. So we put 2 days of qualifying before.
There were six hole matches, was there?
Yeah.
Head to head, six hole matches between good players.
Correct. So we had 24 make, and then they did 12 and 10. But originally I had it so that there'd be six teams of four, or eight teams of four qualify, and Coke would own one team of four. And
you were live before live, Langers.
I was well and truly before live. Mind you, I was also into the Peter Thompson thought that there should be 54 holds. So they grabbed all Liv's ideas. Liv grabbed all Tomo's ideas as well.
Rolling grave if he thought that was the case. I suppose. Well, I interviewed Mary Thompson last year. She said there's no way Peter would not have been a fan of Liv.
He mightn't have been a fan, but they did think ahead of it. So the six hole, it went well, except that the tour, in its wisdom, and didn't want to associate gambling with golf. And so they didn't promote the gambling side of it, which is how the tournament was designed. It was designed to be a gambling event.
As a TV product, you can absolutely see the appeal of a number of six-hole matches, quick results, turn around, go out again. That's a real you can see why people might want to watch that and even adopt that at club level. There would be some.
Well, there are clubs that do play it.
Yeah.
They have a qualifying round and then the top, all hang around the 18th green and watch the matches come through. So it's been success.
Absolutely. And I think the shot clock was your idea. I'm not sure they had it at the Super Six, but they certainly tried it in Europe 1 year, and it was fantastic.
That was mine. That was mine.
Was it a big thing on a trailer behind a golf cart that would tick down and you could watch it? I think they did that in Europe.
And I wanted the crowds to be saying 5, 4, 3. Mightn't have appealed to the player, but I used to get into this philosophical argument. Are we part of the entertainment industry, or are we there as a sport to just
have it right in that at the National Open and the Majors, no, we're not. We're a serious sport, and every other week of the year we should be entertaining.
Entertainment.
The John Deere Classic should just be another entertaining circus product.
Yeah. Well, how entertaining are the current form with the girls and the boys and the?
It's been a revelation.
It's been fantastic.
An absolute revelation. You cannot. I've thrown plenty of brickbats at the PGA and Golf Australia over the years. Give them credit where it's due. They have done an amazing job since COVID of leading the world in what could really be the future format for smaller tournaments.
Yeah.
I do think there's issues about the National Open and having a mixed field, and there's issues about dates with that and those kinds of things. I do understand the point of sponsorship being hard to come by and that being a product that appeals. But yes, I think we kind of need the Tomo model as you laid it out. National Opens should be the most important tournaments, just behind the four majors, and everything else is up for grabs. Yeah. We're not great at innovating in golf, are we?
Well, we don't like to take chances, and you know, we've also trying to fulfil government requirements, and we want 4 days of golf because that looks good to the government, that there's more room nights and everything else. And but there's been a few successes. I mean, along with two other people, David Greenhill and ex-CEO of Victorian Golf.
Simon Brookhouse.
Brookie. Along with Brookie and Greenhill, I feel that I had a bit to do with getting the Vic Open down to 13th Beach because I have a house down there.
You wanted a home game for a change.
But bringing the men and the women together down there on one venue was a revelation. And that event, when it was at its peak, was as big as bigger than the Australian Open. It was, the crowds were fantastic.
It was always the best tournament to go to. It wasn't the most important tournament, but it was the best tournament Correct. To go to by Correct. Far. People, dogs on the fairways, and
yep.
it was just fabulous stuff. I always give David Greenhill credit. I feel like I didn't realize you were also a part of that. Obviously, you would have had to.
Well, I wasn't point, part of the men and women. No, he was the men and women.
It was just, and that's the blueprint for how tournament. And look, it's been trialed in different formats overseas that I don't think work particularly well. The Sandbelt Invitational is an interesting one, the way they do yep. the men and the women, where they change yep. the par as opposed to there's difficulty. But the two side by side, and I know you've got to have the venue for it, but they're not in such short supply that you could have Royal Melbourne, Western East, do a mixed men's and women's yeah. event, not necessarily the Australian Open.
See, I'm not sure that it works for the Australian Open.
I don't think it does.
And to be honest, and, you know,
I wish it did. I really wish it did. I wish the Australian Open could have been the Vic Open.
Well, I don't think that they've learnt the lesson that we learnt. The first year we ran the Vic Open, we had Woodlands and Spring Valley.
Yeah. And Subaru was the sponsor. I don't know why I remember that, but Subaru was the sponsor.
It didn't work because there were people going from here to there, and, you know, when we moved it down to 13th Beach, it just fired because there was one player lounge, there was one administration, there was one courtesy car. There
it was the key that unlocked everything.
It just unlocked everything. And for the Australian Open to come back and then go Kingston Heath and Royal Melbourne or Victoria, it was fine. It was fine, but I think it would be better at Peninsula or Royal Melbourne or 13th Beach even.
Yeah, and that, which also won't answer the scheduling problem, doesn't matter. Whichever end of the year you want to have it at, one of the fields is going to suffer,
yeah.
the way professional international golf looks at it. And scheduling is by far the biggest issue facing professional golf in this part of the world, easily enough. Last thing I want to touch on, there's a million other things we could get you back for another episode comfortably, but it was the Olympics.
Yeah,
you went to the Olympics. It was the first time back in the Olympics, 2016. There was a lot of us are skeptical. I'm still a skeptic. I'm not a great fan of golf necessarily in the Olympics. What was it like from behind the scenes on the other side?
Well, the best way of describing it, on the Tuesday, I ran into Justin Rose, and I was having breakfast with him, and I said, Justin, why are you here when Adam and Tiger and everyone else had a lot of... And he said,
the Zika virus. You remember the Zika virus.
Yeah, the Zika virus. Yeah. Anyway, and I'll never forget the answer. He said, I grew up in England where the Olympics was such a major sporting event, and it's the same here in Australia. And he said, to be selected in an Olympic team, not only does it happen only once every 4 years, you have to be the best two of your sport in your country. And he said, I'll get the opportunity over my career to play in 100 or more majors, but I may only ever get the chance to play one or two Olympics. And as it turned out, he's only played the one, I think.
Yeah.
Hasn't been selected.
Has the silverware, quote unquote, to show that he won the gold.
And I saw him afterwards and I reminded him of it, and he said, it was the best decision I've ever made. And I think you'll find more and more. And it's
generational, isn't it?
It is generational. But what a week it was. Gee, I watched Phelps win that. I watched the Usain Bolt when it was the best week of my life.
Yeah. And nothing to do with the golf.
Nothing
to do with the golf. You've seen all the golfers before. But
the golf was fantastic.
It was fantastic. But, it was a great golf course, much more so than in Japan, I felt. The golf course was a
fabulous match. I felt sorry for Marcus Fraser that he did everything right all week till the last couple of
– Yeah.
Anyway.
But, yeah, he himself will tell you the last thing he ever expected at any point in his life was to own a green or gold tracksuit.
Yep.
No. Be at the Olympics. So, it was a fabulous
– A wonderful representative.
Langers, I'm sure I've missed a bunch of. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention before we go about golf or
weather? Oh, no. Look, I've been so lucky. I've had so many highlights and so many lowlights. Probably the best tournament I was involved with was definitely 2009 Masters with Tiger.
Australia.
I just, when they came over that hill at the sixth, it was just tingling. It was spine tingling.
Yeah.
And it was a funny week in itself on the Tuesday night, and I'm not going to tell you who it was, but one of the Australian boys came up to me and said, I believe Tiger's got his girlfriend from Liverpool, I think it was that year, in town. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And I said, no. He said, keep it to yourself. I said, if that gets out, Tiger will have no choice. You'll have to have done a neck or a back or whatever. We've sold this out 3 months. This cannot, if the journalists get wind of it, it's going to be. Anyway,
of course they did, didn't they? Was it 6 days after?
Well, they got wind of it the day after the tournament finished.
That's right.
And, it became an international incident. Could have happened 5 days earlier, apart from the integrity of one of our Australian boys that kept it to himself.
Yeah, there you go. Aside from that, and this has always been the case every time Tiger's come here, I feel, watching him play on the sandbelt is like watching the world's best violinist find the world's best, whatever the Stratocars, whatever they're called. Isn't it? The two come together and make magic.
Poetry.
Tiger's golf is magic no matter where he plays. You come up to Mangrove Mountain, where I used to be in America, it'd be magic to watch him. But put him on Kingston Heath or Royal Melbourne, and if you're a golf fan, if you love golf, you couldn't imagine watching anything better than that.
Well, as I said earlier, watching him play against in the President's Cup in 2019, I've never seen anyone so disciplined and so it was just.
It's everything, isn't it? It's the execution, the imagination, the knowing which shot to hit when. Because Royal Melbourne is a course, I don't care who you are, at some point you hit it in a diabolical spot that you can't recover from. Every golfer who's ever played it has done it, except it seems Tiger.
Well, it's funny. Tiger's always been Tiger and his thing, but I'll never forget Craig Parry and Peter Lonard said to me once, he said, Tiger should have been Australian. Everything about Tiger is he should have been Australian. He loves barbecues. He loves the courses. He loves the people.
He loves Shane Warne. that qualifies you in Australia. You remember
that's a worry.
You remember the dinner the year after that?
Yeah.
Don't you? When they had the big thing at Brown and it was him and Shane Warne on the
stage.
And I think it was Mark Nichols said, Tiger, have you met Shane Warne? You two might get along.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd seen Tiger smile for a year, I reckon. It was, I think you're right about that. He had the Kiwi caddy, obviously, and Steve Williams, and it does seem to have always gone on well with Australians.
No, he was so good for me, or so good to me. He always came in, and can I just finish with one?
Of course you can.
So that 2009, Masters, he arrived on the Tuesday, played nine holes with Craig Parry. And I was out on the course and our receptionist said, Andrew, Tiger's in the office, wants to see you. And I said, oh, geez, what's wrong
there? You've been summoned. If you're the principal, you've been summoned to the office.
I walk in and I said, g'day, mate, how are you? He said, oh, good, great, you know, just got in. Da, da, da. I said, oh, we got a problem, have we? And he said, no. He said, I'm just about to go and do my media conference, but I thought I'd come and get a bit of background on the. And I said, oh, gee, great. Well, we're going through the biggest drought Australia's ever had. The course is dry. And as you know, the sandbelt's better in February than it is here. And, you know, the greens could be a little bit firmer, but we're in November. And so I've gone through all this stuff. He said, look, I better get over there. So I'll come with you. So I walked over and we walk in and I just stand on the side and. First question, what do you think of the course here at Kingston? Well, as you know, we're going through the worst drought in the history of us. He just quoted verbatim everything. But I thought to myself, no other international has ever come down here and asked me, you know, about the course setup or about this or about that or about that. He was just so professional in the way he handled that media conference. I thought this bloke is pretty good.
He's pretty good. Well, being Tiger Woods is about, well, the golf is the sanctuary for him, you would think. Yeah. Everything else about his life is just chaotic. And yeah. To get on the golf course must be a relief for him, yeah. I would imagine, where it's just him and the ball and the other players.
It's just a shame that he's had that accident and we'll probably never see
him. We've all been robbed, haven't we, in some ways, him included.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Langers, it's been fantastic to chat to you. I appreciate you taking the time. And I'd love
any
to
time, Rob.
Fantastic.
Yeah, loved it.
If you've had anything to do with the Australian golf industry over the last 35 years, you will have undoubtedly come across Andrew Langford-Jones, and it was great to capture some of his thoughts there. Now, I hope you've hit the follow button in your favourite podcast app, because on our next, John Huggan catches up with another golfer of lesser profile but enormous influence.
Well, Michael could do what is the key to the game. He'd get in the hole quickly.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was the key. I mean, look at his record. I mean, you can't argue with his record.
That's Vinnie Giles. Next time on The Thing About Golf.